And welcome to a Juno Afternoon on Monday, January 2nd, 2015. I'm your host, Scott Burton. On today's show, we'll get the details on the Juno World Affair Council's World Quest this Friday. Patricia Wary will be here to showcase the upcoming Beginning Birders course. We'll learn about the Juno Montessori School's fundraising wine and beer tasting event on Saturday. And Kelly Manning and Chris Taylor will be here to highlight the Canvas's fundraising dinner also on Saturday. Those interviews, National Native News, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, music, and more right here on a Juno Afternoon.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Montana's tribal colleges educate many non-Indian students, but they get a lot less state support for doing so than other schools. Montana Public Radio's Christopher Allen reports a Native American state lawmaker is seeking to change that.
Democratic Representative Susan Weber sees community colleges getting more money than tribal colleges to educate the same student and thinks, this isn't right.
Tell me, you know, is that discriminatory or what? That's what angers me.
In Montana, 16% of students at tribal colleges aren't tribal members. If those same students went to non-tribal community colleges instead, the state would fund $2,500 more. Weber wrote a bill that would establish a higher minimum funding level for non-tribal students at tribal colleges, with small increases over time. Laura John, a tribal policy analyst for the nonprofit Montana Budget and Policy Center, says this bill is about more than money. It's about Montana valuing tribal colleges.
They're providing affordable access to education, and that's important, and that's a valuable investment.
John calls Weber's bill a compromise. It would boost state funding for tribal schools, but not to the same level as non-tribal schools for educating non-tribal students. Representative Weber says just getting it closer is like pulling teeth, but she's confident the bill will eventually pass.
That was Christopher Allen reporting. Native leaders continue to pressure U.S. lawmakers about land into trust issues. Matt Laszlo has more from Washington.
6 years ago, a Supreme Court case called Carcieri v. Salazar limited the Secretary of the Interior's ability to set aside lands for tribes that weren't federally recognized before 1934. Native business and political leaders are calling on the Senate Indian Affairs Committee, under new Republican leadership, to finally restore the Secretary's power. Aaron Payman is with the National Congress of American Indians.
Since 2009, this committee has held numerous hearings, favorably passed legislation, and each of the past Congresses, which affirms the original intent of the Indian Reorganization Act and would allow the Secretary of Interior to take lands into trust for all tribes.
Gary Davis is CEO of the National Center for American Indian Enterprise Development. He supports a measure that in the last Congress enjoyed nearly universal support from Democrats on the Senate Indian Affairs Committee, though it's unclear if the GOP will get behind the effort this time.
We recommend focus on high-priority, parity-forging legislation that has gained consensus support in Indian country to, one, restore parity in trust land acquisition by passing legislation like last year's S-2188 so that all federally recognized Indian tribes can protect and enhance their tribal lands to attract investment, create jobs, and build self-sustaining tribal economies.
Though that measure, a so-called Carcieri fix, passed out of the committee last year, even a Democratic-controlled Senate never put it to a full vote. With Republicans in charge, a similar fix is in doubt, and a new one might look totally different. I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
In Canada, an 11-year-old Aboriginal girl in Ontario who quit chemotherapy in favor of traditional medicine has died. Dan Karpinchuk reports.
In a video posted to YouTube less than a year ago, Michaela Salt said she had asked her mother and father to take her off the chemo because she couldn't do it anymore. Salt suffered from acute lymphoblastic leukemia, a form of cancer that has about an 80% success rate of recovery for patients undergoing chemotherapy. But Michaela suffered side effects while undergoing chemo at McMaster Children's Hospital, and so her parents opted for traditional First Nations treatments, despite doctors saying she had no chance of survival without the chemo. The hospital called in child welfare authorities, but after meeting with the parents, the Children's Aid Society said it would not intervene. The hospital also later said it respected the society's decision in the case. Michaela suffered a stroke a couple of weekends ago and died shortly after. The family blames the chemo, saying it did irreversible damage to her heart and major organs, and that caused the stroke. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
The Albuquerque Hispano Chamber of Commerce's Convention and Tourism Department welcomes to Albuquerque the American Indian Higher Education Consortium, March 14th to the 18th. Information on convention services at ahcnm.org.
When you file online for your PFD, every Alaskan can support National Native News. Just use Pick, Click, Give, and select KNBA FM Kawanic Broadcast Corporation. With one donation at a time, good things will happen all over Alaska.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
And you're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Monday, February 2nd, 2015. It's about 6 minutes after the hour. And now in the studio is Carl Broderson and Lauren Jones, both board members on the Juno World Affairs Council. Welcome, Carl. Welcome, Lauren.
Hello.
Thank you.
Nice to have you guys here. So you're getting ready for Friday night's World Quest, sort of one of your flagship events of the year. Tell us about it.
It's the World Quest is an annual event. It's our only fundraiser. All of our events throughout the year are free. So this is the one fundraiser that we have each year to help fund bringing in speakers, the forums we do with the university. So we have a silent auction. We have a dessert auction. We try to have at least one dessert for every table so that people can bid on the desserts, bid them up, and then we pass them out so that they can share with the rest of their table. Sometimes they'll pool the money and things like that. We have an international buffet. The Hangar's doing it again this year. They have a marvelous, marvelous set of food from all around the world. There's Mexican and South American, European, Japanese, Chinese, Thai, Indian. There's just all kinds of really good food on the menu. And then we have a trivia contest that Carl writes the questions for. But this year, Senator Egan is once again going to be moderating that and asking the questions. Usually Sharon Gateman's on there, but she's not going to be here. So Jesse Keel will be doing it this year. And he works for the senator. So that should make for some lively conversation in between questions.
Absolutely. So, Carl, you're the official trivia contest, the famous trivia contest question writer.
Oh, well, yes.
We're going to get to that in just a sec, and maybe you'll give us a few clues about what we should be studying up for on Friday. But in the meantime, Lauren referenced some of the things that you guys do as JWAC. Can you give our listeners just sort of JWAC 101 in case they don't know about you?
Yeah, we bring the world to Juno is the slogan. Have specialists, people who know what they're talking about in terms of world affairs, come and give a presentation. Usually it's an individual speaker all throughout the winter and fall, but then we also have the International Affairs Forum out at UAS, which is a multi-day event that focuses on a specific issue. Most recently it was U.S.-Mexican relations, and it's essentially a longer, bigger talk going into extreme depth.
Okay. We also do a volunteer travelogue. People mm-hmm. in Juneau, as you know, travel a lot, and a lot of our members travel. So usually on a Tuesday evening, somebody who's just back from a trip will do a slideshow and a presentation. We usually have it at the Nickelodeon. In fact, there's one tomorrow night mm-hmm. at 5 o'clock. Elfrieda Nord, who is a longtime member of the Juneau World Affairs Council, former public health nurse, director of public health nursing, and she and another person from Juneau did a Mediterranean cruise, and so she's going to talk about Turkey and Greece and things like that tomorrow night at 5 o'clock. All those events are free. That's why our fundraisers are so important in when we do the World Quest, because all these others are free to the public.
And both you gentlemen have been, you're on the board now, you've been part of JWAC for 7 years, you were telling me earlier. Excuse me. Why is it important to you to be a part of this organization? Carl, you first?
It's very easy to be isolated when you live in the U.S., and especially more so when you live in Juneau, which is, you know, physically isolated. And I think it's just important that people understand what's going on around them, and it's a good way to be a better citizen of the world.
How about you, Lauren?
I think I agree. My wife and I, when I retired in 2003, we did a lot of traveling around the world, and it was very, very positive for us. So being part of the Juneau World Affairs Council, bringing people here, you learn things even though you travel a lot. I'll give you an example. Several years ago, we had a former ambassador to Mongolia here. Well, the lieutenant governor introduced him. I was trying to figure out why the lieutenant governor would be introducing a former. Well, the lieutenant governor at the time was Campbell, and he had been adjutant general of the National Guard. Each state National Guard has a foreign country that they're sort of a partner to. Hmm. Alaska was partner to Mongolia. The ambassador and the general knew each other then. Something I learned by attending one of those sessions was that our National Guard had a relationship with the country of Mongolia. So, in fact, my wife and I are going there in July. We'll be in Mongolia in July this year. So.
Okay. So it sounds like you enjoy the learning aspect of it. I suspect it's also a nice social gathering. Talk to folks, enjoy each other's company.
Oh, certainly at WorldQuest, yeah. A lot of folks coming, 180 to 200 people.
All right, Carl. Again, you are WorldQuest this Friday night. You're the official trivia contest question writer. Did you say you maybe brought some sample questions?
We have a few. I mean, these are sort of the more entertaining, fun ones. But I don't want to give the impression that it's all weird, esoteric stuff like this. Sometimes it's as basic as what is the capital of France, namely
Paris.
Well done, yes. So, I mean, it's a nice even spread. But one example, for example, the color associated with an electrical ground is green in a power box, though often ground wires are just left bare. Inside of a breaker box, which of the following wire colors are you least likely to find? Is it A, red, B, white, C, blue, or D, black?
And, of course, I know the answers to all these questions, but I'm going to leave it to my listeners right now. They're all answering these questions. And somebody probably just called in with blue.
Exactly. Well done.
All right.
So, I mean, it's a wide mixture of things. We try to make them funny and entertaining, and if nothing else, you learn an awful lot. I certainly do writing them. I spend so much time on Wikipedia, it's ridiculous.
And so at the event, how's it work? Is this up on a screen? Are you announcing them?
Yes, two screens. We are super fancy.
We have two screens, and we'll have 25 tables, 8 each. Normally, a table becomes a team. We ask them to name themselves and register their name. And then on one screen, we have the team scores. Mm-hmm. And on the other screen, we'll have the questions. They'll be read. There'll be a break in between so people can go bid on desserts or bid on the other activities. And then their scores. So you watch your team go up and down depending on the categories. You have categories of geography, and you'll have categories of political, sometimes military history, some other history, current events, Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
And so we'll have 5 rounds of 10 questions each, and teams go up and down.
High drama.
And the biggest prize is just lasting glory.
Yes. Who could ask for more?
I suspect it's pretty fun, and some good competition gets going there.
It really is. But it's lighthearted yes. competition, except maybe the top 2 teams. But
yeah, there's a couple, 3 teams each year seem to always be vying for the top, and the rest of us are always also rans.
They might even sort of vet their friends, like who gets to sit at their table.
No, possibly.
Possibly, yeah. They seem to be stacked fairly well with people that really know things.
Mm. There is a perpetual trophy. You can have your team name engraved on it, so it's worth fighting for, but it's just for fun.
It sounds like a lot of fun and going towards a great cause. So that's this Friday at 6 p.m., mm-hmm. and it's at Centennial Hall. How can someone get tickets?
They can get tickets online. Just go to jwac.org, and there will be a block there talk about WorldQuest, and you can buy the tickets online, or you can buy them at the door.
Okay, and how much are they?
$60 for adults and $30 for students. Been the same price for the last 4 or 5 years, and we've tried to keep the price down to get more people in. And at the same time, we probably are having to look at changing that in the next year or so. But
so go now while you can.
Go now while you can, while it's still relatively inexpensive.
4 hours of entertainment and dinner. It's not too bad.
And dinner. That's a good price.
And exotic goods and.
Very much so.
And experiences.
And experiences.
We'll get you out of the country on some of those.
Sounds like fun. Carl Broderson, Lauren Jones, anything else you want to add?
It's a great event. Come on out.
Yeah, have fun. Just if you don't know anybody, just come anyway. There's always a spot at a table.
Yep.
Thanks a lot, guys.
Thank you.
You bet.
Take my stand upon the Blue Ridge Mountain. come and open the door. Lulu, my Lulu, come and open the door. Before I have to walk on in with my old 44. Oh, Lord, I've been all wrong this way.
Listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Monday, February 2nd, 2015. Scott Burton, your host. It's about 18 minutes after the hour, and now in the studio is Patricia Wary. Welcome, Patricia.
Hi.
And you're going to be giving a beginning birders course starting, this Thursday?
This Thursday.
All right. And it's going to go for 5 weeks every Thursday night from 7 to 7:30, right?
7 to 8:30.
Oh, okay.
It's an hour and a half.
All right, at Harborview.
Harborview this time around, and then I'm going to redo this whole program out in the valley.
Well, it sounds like fun. You've been teaching in the high school recently. I want to talk about that in a minute. We'll talk about more about this class. When did you start birding, Patricia?
Mm-hmm. Well, I imagine as a kid I've been interested. I was raised in eastern Washington on a fruit farm,
uh-huh.
Soft fruits. And my father was sending us out all the time to stir up the birds so they wouldn't peck holes in the cherries, because he got docked for damaged culls, they were called. He got docked for that. So we were out there stirring up the birds.
And how would you stir up a bird?
Well, my brothers were sent out with pellet guns, and I just went out exploring.
Mm. So you were doing more observing, I suspect?
Yeah, they did more stirring.
And tell me a little bit about birding here in Juneau. Where do you like to go? What continues to keep you interested?
Well, they're everywhere. Right near my home for several winters now, some red-winged blackbirds, the males, have stayed in town. They haven't migrated further away. And this year I even see the females are with them. Unless they've come back earlier, females must have started spending the winters here. And that's exciting to see those changes. And because that's happened quite recently, they found a food source, and then they found another one close in the area, so they haven't left.
And may I ask, have you noticed what they're eating?
Well, when they started out, there were some spruce trees that must have been very buggy at the top.
Huh.
They were starting to lose their needles, and that was the year that I heard in the winter and couldn't believe I was hearing that in the winter. The red-winged blackbirds, they make a distinctive call. And I was hearing them in the winter, but they were up there. And then the next winter, they had cleaned out that source, and they moved to somebody's feeder. When they come to mine, they don't stay very long. I think they might like the bigger sunflower seeds. I don't think they like the millet that the little birds do that I put out.
Because I was going to ask you, do you suspect that it's climate inspired that they stayed here? But I remember last winter was pretty cold and snowy, and mm-hmm. it seems like we were having a milder winter now. But it does sound like it has it's related more to the food, maybe.
Well, it may be a calmer winter, and a source of food got them staying. And if they're in the habit of it, and they can keep finding food, well and good. That lady that was putting out the feed that first drew them away from the spruce trees the following winter, they went on vacation, so the birds weren't being fed there for a while. So it'll be interesting to see where they go next winter, what their winter place will be.
Sure, sure. So tell us a little bit about this class, Patricia, and some of the things that you plan to cover.
Okay. Well, I have a thing that is supposed to be a bird, and it's not any particular bird. It's got a hat on it, and they sort of look like bird feet, and the cloth is supposed to be feathers, so it stands for birdness. It's not any particular bird. So we start with birdness, and I take people and I change them slowly into birds, so we learn about the different body parts of a bird. And then the other four meetings, we move into identifying the different clues that you use and some of the common birds around here in the different times. So the ones that winter here, the ones that migrate through here, the ones that breed here, about four different groups that I'll cover. And they're all local Juno birds that I'll help people learn to identify.
And so that sounds like a hands-on activity there, sort of exploring mm-hmm. its birdness. What are a few other examples of hands-on activities you do?
Well, one of the ways you describe a bird is size. You say, oh, that's as small as a sparrow, or it's bigger as a sparrow, or it's smaller than a robin. So a sparrow, a robin, and a crow are kind of standards that you use in birding. And that doesn't really mean anything until you do something hands-on. So I have a couple of different light bulb sizes, and I have a container. And in 5 minutes, I ask people, these sets of people, to make birds. So they're feeling what at least one side of a bird is, size is, and then they look at the other two sizes. And then I have some life-size cutouts of birds and ask them, which do you think this is more like? Is it more like the sparrow size? Is it more like this? For just a quick reality check on what does that mean to be those sizes.
Yeah. Okay, it sounds like a lot of fun. And does this class cost any money?
Yes, it is offered through community schools. This one, because of the amount of hours, is $37.50.
For five sessions.
Yes.
Okay, and it's Thursday night, 7 to 8:30 at Harborview Elementary. And it does sound like a lot of fun. Again, you have to go to Juneau Community Schools to sign up.
You can go online to do it. I'd like to know how many people I'm going to have and even email them some things ahead of time. But I have registered people at the class site. But there's a limited number. I'm doing 12. And then to protect myself, made enough for 14. But their class size is limited because I can't help that many people. We're working sets of twos, and I can handle 6-7 sets of twos. But beyond that, I won't have fun. And if I don't have fun, you're not having fun.
Speaking of having fun, you mentioned you've been in the high school having a lot of fun, and you'd like to do more of that. Tell us a little bit. How are high school students responding to birds?
Well, I was trying to lure them into this program, mm-hmm. and I thought, well, I'll put on a good show and get them interested and draw them in. But I think there's just too much goes on in the school day for them to come afterwards. But I was invited by a science teacher there, Henry Hopkins, to come and use a whole class period in his five science classes. And I thought, okay. But I got there, and I mixed and matched all kinds of bird things. And, you know, I had them picking up little scraps of paper with chopsticks to understand that they need more vertebrae in their neck. And they liked doing the stranglehold on another kid because they were a tree with a hole in it. And there are a number of five ducks whose children are hatched out in a tree. And then they have to jump. And so the one particular boy, he was jumping from 20 feet as a one-day-old chick to the ground. Kerplump! And he did it less gracefully than the little ducks do.
So you're saying there are some ducks that are
yeah.
hatched in trees?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that sounds really interesting. And if somebody wants to learn more about that, they can come to your class. Remind me once more, Patricia, where somebody can sign up.
Online at community schools.
Okay.
And then last resort at the class.
Okay. Starts this Thursday, 7 to 8:30 at Harborview. Anything we're missing, Patricia?
Lot. You haven't come to the class.
All right. Well, thanks again.
All right. Thank you.
This is Bird Note. Today, a memory of summer in the midst of winter from Bird Note writer Todd Peterson, titled Why I Fish.
In the last light of a summer day, I'm casting a dry fly to a few trout rising to make rings on the still water of a remote lake. A silver crescent moon rises. It's utterly still, quiet. As the darkness grows, trout begin to rise all around me and all across the lake. Bats dart through the air. Veiled clouds of midges drift across the water. A loon calls. The place is filled with life. My father took me to places like this, and what places they were. The St. Joe River in the Bitterroot Mountains of northern Idaho, where the cutthroat trout hid in green depths of crystal water, glinting with the flash of mica. The Elk River near British Columbia's wild border with Alberta, where we listened to the hermit's tales of crossing the Rocky Mountains in winter. And Ponderay Lake, where the silver-sided kokanee were so abundant the limit was 50. My father is gone now, but being in the places where wild fish live brings me again into his presence, the man who gave me life.
Down by the bay, where the watermelons grow, back to my home, I dare not go, for if I do, my mother would say, did you ever see a whale with a polka dot tail, down by the bay, where the watermelons grow, back to my home, I dare not go.
And you're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Monday, February 2nd, 2015. And now in the studio with me are folks from the Juno Montessori School. And Jeff Kirsch, Charlene Smith, and Paige, welcome to the three of you.
Hi.
Hi, thanks.
Nice to have you. Tell me about what we were just listening to.
That was a recording that one of the parents made of the Juno Montessori School toddler community singing one morning. That's pretty fun to do.
Yeah, and Charlene, tell me about your capacity there at the Montessori.
I'm currently the executive director at the Juno Montessori School. For years, I worked in the classrooms, both the primary classroom and then the toddler community for years. In the last 2 years, I've been the executive director there.
All right, and how about you, Jeff?
I, believe it or not, am the president of the board of directors of that school, and actually have been for a couple of years, and also have sent both my children there. One still goes there, and Paige, who was introduced at the top, she is a product of Juno Montessori School. So, yeah. She doesn't have much to say. This is the first time that she's been in a radio control room. So,
all right, Paige, if you change your mind, you can get on that microphone whenever you're ready. So the Juno Montessori School, you're located over there in Douglas by Sandy Beach.
Yes, that's right.
And will you tell us a little bit more about the school, age range, grade range, all that?
Sure. Yeah, we have two primary classrooms for 3 to 6-year-olds, and we go through kindergarten. And we also have one toddler community, which is 15 months to 3 years. And we have 12 students in that class. And we're located right, as you said, right by Sandy Beach.
Yep, in that Mayflower building. And actually, this year, the 2015, the school is celebrating its 30th anniversary. So
30 years in Juno. Lots of kids coming through.
And pursuant to that, but also to why we're here in the studio, is that, we're hosting a fundraiser. We got an annual fundraiser going. This is the second year, so I guess that does count as annual, of a wine and beer tasting. Which is going to be coming up on this Saturday. So, I mean, that's what we're in general trying to do is get some people to come on out and taste some wine and help pay for so our school is a need-blind school. So we accept, basis of just, if there's space, then we'll take them. And then it's up to us to figure out how financial aid is going to work. And so that's fundraising, comes into it. For this specifically and other things, obviously, but yeah.
Sure. So that's going to be this Saturday night at what time?
It's 5 to 8 p.m. at the Hangar Ballroom.
Okay. And it's $35, and it is featuring all three distributors, beverage distributors in town, and so they're going to be pouring whatever it is they pour, but like a nice selection of reds and whites and craft beer, and it's $35. And it is a no children event. Event. It's 21 and up. But Maria Montessori obviously was Italian, and so I think she would approve of the wine tasting element of this whole thing.
Charlene, speaking of Maria Montessori, can you talk to us a little bit about sort of the Montessori way?
Sure.
How does
yeah.
it differ from, say, quote unquote, normal school?
The traditional education.
Traditional, yeah.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Montessori based all of her methods of education and observation of children. And so she really came at it from a different perspective rather than what do children need to know. She started looking at how do children learn and what do they need to reach their optimal potential. And she started designing specific environments for different age ranges of children. And the teachers are specially trained. All of our teachers have undergraduate degrees first, and then they get their Montessori training on top of that. But basically to observe the children, find out what they need, what their interests are, and then hook them into things that they're interested in. And by using the materials in a hands-on experiential way, they're then able to take those concepts and extrapolate from there. So they're basically using the materials to teach themselves about the world. And it really gets them hooked into what they're interested in, and then they can follow that interest and passion into a wide variety of different kinds of fields. And, it's interesting to see even toddlers, they come in and people are often like, well, what are you going to do with a toddler in terms of education, right? But the children are exploring the world and everything is so new to them, so we just set up activities that they then choose themselves, explore themselves, and then have this deep sense of satisfaction of, oh, I can do this. I know how this works. I'm getting this figured out. It's really lovely to see how much self-confidence and competency they come up with, even as they're just not even really verbal yet.
Sounds like you're very passionate about it.
I am. I particularly love the under three set, just because I think they can do so much more than we as adults think they can do. And then when they get into those kinds of environments where they're allowed to really explore that way, they really do show you what they can do. It's really pretty mind-boggling, actually.
I bet.
Yeah.
Hey, Paige, by any chance, do you feel like telling us about maybe your favorite thing to do at school?
What was your favorite thing, Paige, when you went to Montessori school? What was your favorite thing there? And right into that microphone. What do you think, Paige? You don't know.
Well, maybe, Jeff.
Paige really enjoyed practical life skills. That's like a one area. And I remember so part of that is polishing silver. And we went back home for Thanksgiving one year, and Paige polished all of my mother-in-law's silver. Like, she dumped the whole thing. They also, both my kids like to peel potatoes, and that's something that they do. And they're both very adept at shelling hard-boiled eggs. That's, like, another thing. But, you know, like, buttoning things and stuff. And Paige likes to sew. She made, I mean, many pillows and doll clothes. And actually, one thing, and this is very different from silver polishing, which has its benefits. But Paige, she graduated last year in kindergarten. She actually wound up writing and directing and producing a short play.
Wow.
That they then did in that little amphitheater out by Sandy Beach. And, yeah, that was really kind of neat,
yeah,
actually.
Yeah, all the children performed in it. Everyone had a role.
It was very adorable, obviously. But it was really good. It was a play. What was the play? What was the play called, Paige?
Luna the Butterfly.
Say it right into the microphone nice and loud.
Luna the Butterfly.
Luna the Butterfly. And it was a story about a butterfly, and I guess, like, her friends wanted to do something that she didn't want to do, so she suggested something else, and then they all had a really fun afternoon together. But, I mean, this it had costumes and scenery and, like, the whole thing. It was really great.
You know, I wanted to go back to something Jeff was saying about the practical life, because I think this is one thing that parents and other members of the community might not understand about Montessori, but that value of practical life. Because that's where the children are really, when they're very young, engaging in things that they see people all around them doing but aren't often invited to do. And all those motor skills and all that fine motor and gross motor movement skill really lays a really strong foundation of neurological construction that then later more abstract concepts are laid over on top of. So it's this really important piece of drawing the body and mind together through an activity that then leads to concentration. And I mean, one of the big things that any of us in education would like to see is children being able to concentrate, because then you can really, really do some big work. And so all of that practical life experience brings the mind and the body together to focus on something that lays a really strong neurological foundation.
Okay. So we're talking about the Juno Montessori School.
Yeah.
And also, this Saturday is going to be a fundraiser, the wine and beer tasting event at the Hangar from 5 to 8 p.m. Charlyn Smith, the ED of the Juno Montessori School,
Can we mention that the tickets are available at Hearthside and also at the door, and you can also go to our website. What's the website again?
It's www.junomontessorischool.org.
For information about tickets and stuff in general. I'm sorry, please, Scott, continue your outro.
I was going to mess up on your position, though, Jeff. It's the
president of the board of directors of Juno Montessori School.
Awesome.
It really just means that I preside over the board meetings, and, like, you know, it's not, it's more, it's like I'm more like a figurehead.
Well, thanks very much, and thank you too, Paige. Are we missing anything?
Paige, did you want to say thank you?
Thank you.
You're welcome. Here's Writer's Almanac.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday, the 2nd of February, 2015. It's the anniversary of the founding of the National League in baseball, 1876, 30 years after the first recorded baseball game in Hoboken, New Jersey, in which the New York Knickerbockers lost 23-1 to the New York 9. The first professional club had been the Cincinnati Red Stockings, formed in 1869, and 2 years later a league was formed, but there was a lot of gambling going on, and teams were springing up in cities that were too small to support them, and one team, the Boston Red Stockings, completely dominated that league, and so they started another one. Eight teams joining together on this day in 1876, meeting in New York City. 1922, on this day, Ulysses by James Joyce was published on Joyce's 40th birthday. It had taken him 7 years to write and edit. As he was editing it, his eyesight got worse and worse so that he could hardly make out the print. Finally sent the manuscript off to a printer out in Dijon. Joyce was living in Paris at the time. The type was set by printers who did not know English, so there were many, many errors on the page proofs, which James Joyce continued to revise. He added 100,000 words to the page proofs during the printing process. Many mistakes remained, but on this day in 1922, a copy of the book arrived at Joyce's apartment, and he took his friends out to an Italian restaurant, Ferrari's, to celebrate. And it's the birthday of the novelist Ayn Rand, born Alyssa Rosenbaum in St. Petersburg, Russia, 1905. She was 12 years old when the Russian Revolution broke out. She saw the first guns fired from the balcony of her family home. Communists took over her father's shop, and her family was reduced to poverty. She went to college in St. Petersburg, but when she got a visa to visit relatives in Chicago, she vowed never to return. Came to America. After 6 months, she moved to Hollywood to become a screenwriter, published her first screenplay in 1932, and that allowed her to work on novels in her spare time. Her first important novel was The Fountainhead, came out in 1943, about an architect named Howard Rourke, who blows up a housing project he built because his design was corrupted by the influence of others. His philosophy is that in order to achieve greatness, individuals have to be allowed to realize their own personal vision, not be tied down by society, which was Rand's philosophy, which he called objectivism. Here's a poem for today by Alan Feldman entitled The Coyote. If you stripped a dog of its social eagerness, gave it a loping indifference to human presence, and starved it, you'd have a coyote stalking like a shadow among the garbage cans at the top of Pearl Street near the Fine Arts Work Center. We're heading back to our car through a fine mist, the street lights haloing amid the black trees, and we stop watching him appear and disappear, gaunt as a Giacometti. He's nothing like a dog bounding into the street. Does he care if this is a street or just a hard place under his paws? Ever since childhood, I've tried to be alert to what people are up to. But why not see the coyote's point of view, how he prefers to ignore them, following his own track through the darkness? Alan Feldman's poem, The Coyote, from his collection Immortality, published by University of Wisconsin Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Progressive Insurance, working to make progress for more than 75 years. Produced by Joy Biles, assisted by Kathy Roach. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
And you're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Monday, February 2nd, 2015. It's about 45 minutes after the hour, and from the canvas now is Kelly Manning and Chris Taylor here in the studio. Welcome, Chris and Kelly.
Thanks.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
It's nice to have you here. So, Kelly, remind me of your position at the canvas.
I'm the director of the canvas.
All right, and Chris?
The artistic coordinator.
Okay, but you're going to be moving.
Yes.
We're going to be really sad to see you go. And in a minute, we're going to tell everyone who your successor is going to be, right?
Fantastic, yeah.
But in the meantime, we're going to talk about the Canvas fundraising dinner coming up on Saturday. Pretty
yes.
exciting. But before we even get to that, how about bringing us up to date on what's going on at the Canvas in general?
Yeah, things are going great down there. It's actually a pretty busy week. We have Anari Kalanin. We'll be opening her show for this first Friday. That'll be a series of acrylic paintings that are all new pieces, and she's a great colorist, so the pieces have a lot of nice color, and they're kind of whimsical and a little bit of a dark edge to them, so we're pretty excited for that show.
What does she work in?
Acrylic paints.
Okay.
Yep. And
people might recognize some of, you know, like her style. She's worked with Alaska Robotics and sold work through there, so people will probably recognize her from there. And so she's having a solo show with us. Mm-hmm. We're excited about it. And she's been working with us the past year with our students who experience disabilities. So the December show, if people saw that at the Canvas, that had some of her influence because she was sharing her skills with the class. So she's been engaged with the Canvas. She's pretty engaged in the arts community here in Juneau and really has a very unique style. So it's worth coming and checking it out.
Okay. What else is going on?
And then we'll be partnering with COPA this first Friday as well. We'll be showing our tiles from the bonfire firing. So we still have that project in motion, the tile mosaic project. And we've been cleaning and glazing the tiles, and they'll be on display for people to check out if they participated in it. Maybe their piece will be on display. And mostly it's informational thing for people to come in and learn about the project and what the next steps will be, and we'll have some people there to answer questions.
And will that actually be at COPA? Or?
Yep, it'll be okay. At COPA, and it'll be on display. So we've figured out a way. Brandon Howard designed a pretty cool way to display the tiles, and it'll be up all month, so people can stop in, and we'll have people there during First Friday to answer questions and whatnot, but it'll be up all month if you want to stop in and check out the tiles.
And for folks that don't know about this ongoing project, it's very cool. Kelly, can you let them know?
Yeah, absolutely. Brandon Howard had conceived of the project, and it's incorporating all of the community and highlighting the students that we serve with disabilities and creating a mural for the side of the building at Reach. And he had been walking past and seen that there was this spot that was just kind of filled and painted, and it kind of matched the wall, so nobody really noticed it. But there was this big gaping hole in the wall, and he was like, "Why don't we put some art in there instead of leaving it?" And came up with this great concept for a real community engagement project that's using ceramic tiles that people have helped with in August, creating some of the tiles, and that's what we'll have at COPA. And then we're working on generating the rest of the work to complete the mural through the spring. So we're hoping to have that installed in the summer. But it's a good opportunity to kind of see the direction it's going, see the tiles for people that participated in the project that haven't gotten to see their work come through yet, and have a sense of where it's going.
Yeah, and I'm trying to think back to that August event, a beautiful afternoon there on Sandy Beach, people decorating tiles in one of the shelters, running around on the beach, and then the big fire
big
afterwards
fire.
To fire the actual tiles.
Yeah.
Pretty cool event. Pretty cool ongoing project in general. I can't wait to see it.
Yeah, I'm excited to see the end product, too.
Yeah, we're excited to see it all come together, and it'll be a great way to highlight, too, the student artwork, the Reach Artist work, and then to incorporate the community piece. So it's really nice to see all that coming together.
Yeah, I love any time I walk by the Canvas, something's going on there. There are folks inside making art. There are always people there. There's art in the gallery. A very cool organization.
Yeah, there's a lot going on down there. It's a good spot to be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And if one wants to support this kind of art, this kind of creation, this kind of community togetherness, you can come. You can come to the fundraising dinner on Saturday. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. So we've done this. The last 3 years we've done this where we do a seated dinner, and the Canvas has a long history of doing a fundraising dinner each year. And so the last few years we've done it where we have a seated dinner, you come, you pay for your meal, and with it you get a plate that is hand-thrown by our pottery studio manager, decorated with a design by one of our Reach artists. And this year it's a train design by one of our artists, Gary Peterson. And so the plates are going to be really beautiful. And then we've had really great collaborations. And this year we're collaborating with V's Cellar Door. And they're right across the street from the Canvas. And they've been wonderful to work with. They've been a lot of fun. They're really excited. And so V, Venetia of V's Cellar Door, and Joe Manning are going to collaborate to prepare an Asian fusion dinner. And we're really excited to see that come together. And we've been getting great donations from community, Costco, IGA, Safeway, Walmart, and Food Service of America have all donated food. So that helps because then the donation in your ticket really goes back into serving the canvas, which is wonderful.
Yeah, tell us what the night looks like. It's from 6 to 9. What are seatings like? Where do people actually sit and so forth?
So we transform the studio space at the canvas into the dining space, and everything in the studio we've put up on wheels so we can get it all out of the way, and it's really opens up nicely, so we'll have all the tables in there. We'll get a nice spread going, and then in the gallery we'll have the silent auction set up, so the night will start off from 6 to 7 with the silent auction, and then 7 o'clock we'll start doing dinner.
Yeah.
And then that'll continue till 9 o'clock.
Yeah. Throughout the evening, we have Tom Loker playing piano, and as we all know, he's just fabulous. So that's a nice piece to add. And so he plays piano. We have the silent auction. It really creates that nice ambiance. We have appetizers and then do the seated dinner. And then after dinner, then we close out the silent auction and wrap up with dessert. And this year, we're working with the new owner of Pie in the Sky, Jesty Burton, and so we're really excited about seeing what she's going to do, because she's kind of going off of the theme of the dinner, so we're still waiting. She's sort of surprising us with what dessert's going to be, but we're really looking forward to it, so it'll be a great event.
Sounds like a lot of fun. If somebody wants to go and get tickets, where should they go?
Yeah, they can call us at the Canvas, and our number's 586-1750, or stop in at the gallery, 223 Seward Street, and if they call, we can just, you know, we're just basically reserving their spot. And so it's $60 for a ticket. Again, that includes dinner and the actual plate that you take home with you at the end of the evening. So they can come right into the canvas or give us a call.
Okay. And that's this Saturday, 6 to 9 p.m.
Fantastic.
Fundraiser. So, Chris, it's going to be sad to see you go. Thank you for everything you've done for the community.
I love Juno. It's been a blast being here. And I hope to continue to be engaged with Juno and with the canvas in the future.
And you're going to be going off to make some art on your own for a while, huh?
Yep, heading to New York City and to paint and check out their art scene. So.
All right, well, best of luck to you.
Thank you.
Who's going to be taking your place?
Brandon Howard is going to be stepping out of the ceramic studio and stepping into the artistic coordinator position. We're really excited. He's going to do a fantastic job, and he's always has a ton of ideas, and I'd say in the last 2 weeks since we let him know, he's had nothing but a list of ideas and fun things to get going. So I think the canvas is going to continue to grow and have some really great things going on, so I keep an eye on it for sure.
Absolutely. Kelly, one more time, your phone number and website for the fundraiser this Saturday?
Yeah, the website for the canvas is www.canvasarts.org, and you can give us a call at 586-1750.
Kelly Manning, Chris Taylor, thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Scott.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Thank you.
And you're listening to Midori, Juno Jazz and Classics Concert, on Tuesday, February 10th at 7:30 at the Juno Douglas High School Auditorium. You'll be able to hear this music in person, be able to see Midori in person. For more information, go to Juno Jazz and Classics, or just jazzandclassics.org, the Jack Hearthside Books. I'll have tickets and information, or you can call 463-3378. Tomorrow on a Juno Afternoon, we'll meet Juno Symphony conductor candidate Wesley Scholes. Aaron Hood will be here to showcase his new study on melting glaciers. We'll talk with Brandon Howard about Tiles and Fire, this month's first Friday exhibit at the Canvas. Heard a bit about that today. We'll get to hear more tomorrow from Brandon. And we'll find out about this week's FASD Forum at Centennial Hall. That Writer's Almanac, Bird Note Music, and more right here on a Juno afternoon. And the weather currently 31 degrees at the Juneau Airport. And tomorrow, increasing clouds, highs 28 to 34. North winds only 10 to 20 miles per hour. Wednesday, partly cloudy. Chance of snow, highs around 31. Northeast wind 10 to 20 miles per hour. Thursday, sunny, windy, highs around 24. And Friday and Friday night, mostly cloudy, windy, chance of snow, highs around 18. Lows around 17. Stay tuned for All Things Considered.